Welcome to Healthcare Unfiltered. I am your host, Shadi Nabhan, a hematologist and a medical oncologist, and I have interest in all aspects of healthcare delivery, treatment, leadership, mentorship, and policy. Today's podcast is really important for the science aficionados, because you probably heard in 2023, mid to late 2023, so much discussion, so much really data and so many articles about how the treatment of sickle cell disease is being transformed drastically. Because in sickle cell disease, we know why the disease occurs. We know where the defect it is. Sickle cell disease is a hematological disease that affects mainly African-American population. But the reason it occurs is because we identify a defect in what we call the beta globin subunit of the adult hemoglobin. Well, if we know why it occurs and where it occurs, why can't we treat it? And what you're going to learn is many scientists have tried to do so for many, 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 many years until recently, where in 2023, there was a huge breakthrough in the treatment of this disease. And one of these therapies have been a treatment that utilized the CRISPR technology. And one of the scientists and physicians and clinicians that have been very much involved in the treatment and the design of the trials that led to changing how we approach sickle cell disease is Dr. James LaBelle, who is an associate professor of pediatrics, and he is the director of the Pediatric Stem Cell and Cellular Therapy Program at the University of Chicago here in the south side of Chicago. And guess what? Yes, he is my guest on today's podcast on Healthcare Unfiltered to tell us about sickle cell disease and to also explain to us the various therapies and treatments of this devastating disease that affects many patients and lead to shortening their lifespan. This is a podcast that you should not miss. And if you are listening to it, kudos, you are not missing it. But what you need to do is subscribe to the show, rate it, write a brief review, and share this podcast and other episodes with your friends and colleagues who have interest in healthcare. Very grateful to Dr. LaBelle for coming on my podcast, and I ask you to consider visiting my website, shadinabhan.com. If you want to read a book, Toxic Exposure, The True Story of the Monsanto Trials and the Search for Justice. My second book, by the way, is coming out in the fall of 2024. I'll make a formal announcement very soon about that. Without further ado, Dr. James LaBelle, exclusively on the Healthcare Unfiltered podcast. James, welcome to the show. You go by James or Jim, or what do we do?
James is perfect. Coach James, is called Jim, so James, that's perfect. Yeah.
James is perfect. So Dr. James LaBelle, it's his first time on Healthcare Unfiltered, and we certainly hope he's going to come back on future episodes. And this is really such an important episode because we're going to be talking a lot about science and probably one of the most impactful changes in the way we treat an unfortunate disease, honestly, since I've been practicing medicine. So first of all, congrats for all of the work you've been doing and welcome to the show. And let's start by getting to know you as who you are, where you work, what you do, and what got you into what you're doing currently.
Sure. Shadi, thanks so much for the invitation. It's fun. So I am a pediatric oncologist who specializes in bone marrow transplantation. I grew up in Chicago and did my training, my medical school and graduate school training in Milwaukee, and then did my clinical training and postdoctoral training in hematology and oncology at the Dana-Farber and Boston Children's Hospital. And that's really where it's one of the epicenters of the red blood cell and learning about hematology in general. And I came to the University of Chicago now 12 years ago, and I am now the director of our pediatric transplant and cellular therapy program, and have a lab as well that's sort of dedicated to not what we're going to talk about today per se, but dedicated to immune therapy and drug delivery.
How did you get involved into, as part of your work, you see all kind of pediatric patients, the clinical piece or a specific subset, or how did, tell us about your clinical work.
So I got involved in bone marrow transplantation very early on. I was very interested in replacing diseased bone marrow with other person's bone marrow and understanding the immunologic complications of that. And that I did in Milwaukee, and I was part of the Center for the International Bone Marrow Transplant Registry is. And so it was there that I really became interested in immunology and transplantation. When I was in Boston, I then became much more interested in understanding how you can target certain cell populations for therapeutic intervention, right? Like everywhere else in the world, we've become much more targeted. And it was there that I really sort of grew my hematologic chops. And I became associated with gene therapy and its use in pediatrics through transplantation. Because the only way you can get it in patients right now for hematologic malignancies, maybe not in the future, but for right now, is to do a bone marrow transplant. And so I became involved in, myself and some other folks around the country became involved when this study was in its infancy, when many of these sort of gene therapy studies were in its infancy, long before they were FDA approved from a transplant angle. But I see in our clinic here at the University of Chicago, we have a very large population of patients with sickle cell disease. We're on the sort of, as you know, we're on the south side of Chicago, and we have lots of folks from Africa. They're African Americans that carry the disease. And so our group at the University of Chicago cares for about 750 pediatric and adolescents with sickle cell disease. And that's how I really became involved in treating those patients when I came to the University of Chicago.
So the reason I wanted to have you on this podcast is just the breakthrough data that has been published everywhere, lay press, medical press, everything, New England Journal of Medicine and all other outlets, CRISPR technology in sickle cell disease. So what I thought is we need to give like a quick background to viewers and listeners. What is sickle cell disease? Quick background to viewers and listeners. What is CRISPR? And then how do we really marry these together? And what did you do to change literally the course of this disease? So what is sickle cell disease?
Sure. Sickle cell disease is a disease in which the normal red blood cell that carries oxygen to our body. Red blood cells are the things that we talk about when we're anemic, when they're low, people get tired. But patients with sickle cell disease, when the oxygen level in their blood goes down from infection, from exercising, from temperature changes, the actual red blood cell changes shape, and it changes shape to be an elongated, sickled, sticky cell, right? That no longer is able to flow freely through those small venules in our body, the very tips of our finger or the organs, and it gets clogged, and it leads to severe complications such as debilitating pain crises. It can lead to stroke. It can lead to lung failure, pulmonary failure, renal failure, and it's really a worldwide debilitating disease. It's predominantly seen in people who have African ancestry, sub-Saharan African ancestry. So it's mostly seen in the United States and the African American population. And it shortens their life. It's a terrible disease. The average lifespan of someone in America, the life expectancy for a patient with sickle cell disease is around 45 years old, which is... Wow. It's terrible. 11% of patients under the age of 18 will have developed stroke because of sickle cell disease in the United States. And in non-Westernized countries, where 75% of patients, of the 300,000 patients born with sickle cell disease every year, 75% of them are in sub-Saharan Africa, where the life expectancy is very low. I mean, children die of this in infancy. And it's just a devastating worldwide disease that causes lots of problems. And interestingly, in the Western world, the first discovery of what sickle cell was actually made in Chicago by a Chicago physician. His name was James Herrick. And there was a dental student at the time, I believe he was 20 years old, and he was from Granada. And he was here and he was severely anemic and having pain episodes. And when they looked at his blood under the microscope, they saw normal round, sort of donut looking red blood cells, but they also saw these sickled or elongated cells. And that's where the first description of a sickled cell came from. So it came from Chicago.
Amazing. So, and we'll get into CRISPR in a little bit. Today, when you have a sickle cell disease patient, forget CRISPR for a second, what has been traditionally the treatment for sickle cell disease? I mean, you obviously need to treat the pain, you get pain medicine, but is there anything that you'd have been able to do to treat the actual biology of disease?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, no. While the discovery of the molecular basis of sickle cells was determined in the 50s, the 1950s, it has been stubbornly difficult to treat or cure. The only way to treat patients with sickle cell disease who had some of these complications that we talked about were regular blood transfusions, to literally exchange their sickled blood with normal blood from from donors, and those patients would get transfusions every month to help prevent stroke, to help prevent all of these pain crises that we're talking about. And then the other medication that was used up until about 10 years ago, not quite even till 2017, was a drug called hydroxyurea. And hydroxyurea is actually a chemotherapeutic, but we use it at very, very low doses for patients with sickle cell disease. And the way hydroxyurea works with patients with sickle cell disease, it does a couple things, but one of the things is it decreases the amount of inflammation. Patients with sickle cell disease have a fantastic amount of inflammation because their red blood cells don't last very long. They're anemic. They become very sticky. They get joint problems and pain in their bones. And their sort of global inflammation is very, very high, which leads to a circular disease pattern. At the same time, hydroxyurea increased a form of sickle cell, a form of hemoglobin that I'm sure we'll talk about, and it's called fetal hemoglobin. It's a kind of hemoglobin that we all had when we were in our mothers as a fetus, and right around the time of birth, we exchange that fetal hemoglobin for what we're going to have as adult hemoglobin in red blood cells. And in patients with sickle cell disease, the hemoglobin is no good. But in patients who don't have sickle cell disease, it's fine. And so what they found was, interestingly, that this drug, hydroxyurea, pushed the bone marrow to make some of these fetal hemoglobin kinds of hemoglobin, and it helps attenuate the disease, doesn't cure the disease. Those were our only treatments, and pain medications, and admission to the hospital, and things like that. The only definitive treatment for patients with sickle cell disease is a bone marrow transplant. And that's how I grew up. That's what I learned. And in the first bone marrow transplant for patients with sickle cell disease was performed in 1985. And it took until 2007. And at that point, at 2007, I think there were around 400 patients in an international database that had been transplanted had a bone marrow transplant for sickle cell disease. A fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the patients in the world. And so it's really a devastating illness in which we have not been able to make headway until recently.
I appreciate that because I think I want to make sure that listeners and viewers really understand the impact of the disease to appreciate the discovery that you and your team and your collaborators have done. So it's a good segue. What is CRISPR for the non-scientist?
Yeah, exactly. So CRISPR is quite honestly revolutionary. It's a revolutionary way of changing the genes that might be diseased in our body and replacing them or stopping, either replacing them with a gene that works or taking out the gene that doesn't work, right? And remarkably, you know, the normal projection from discovery of a drug, and you know this more than I, to actual pill form or actually giving it to someone is, you know, on average 17 to 20 years, right? Amazingly, CRISPR, this way of changing genes, was discovered 11 years ago. And, you know, Jennifer Doudna won the Nobel Prize for this. And, you know, 10 years later, it is now a bona fide therapy that is only going to expand. And it's easiest, the easiest way to understand this is that you take pieces of DNA that you make in the lab. It's very simple to do nowadays. Using the four components of the DNA, these are called nucleotides, and you match them to whatever sequence in the genome and in the genes in our body. And we know those sequences now because of the Human Genome Project, and it's easy. You know, what took us months and months and months to do now, we do in a day. And so we know a lot about the sequence of sickle cell disease, the gene that makes sickle cell disease, the sequence of other genes that work to make sickled hemoglobin. Mm-hmm. And so we make that as a guide. That guide is able to bind to that specific sequence, and CRISPR does its magic and, based on that guide, changes the DNA.
So James, can you do CRISPR on me and make me an athlete like a Michael Jordan?
I would love that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes. George Clooney. I always wanted to clone myself.
Obviously the question is a bit sarcastic, but a bit not, right? I mean, like, a couple of years ago, I'm trying to remember the outlet, there was a lot of backlash. I believe there were some Chinese scientists. They talk. I don't remember exact detail. I don't want to slaughter it. But you remember the story that CRISPR could? Is it ethical? Are we really doing the right thing? You remember that?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I think that story was they had changed actually the receptor that allowed things like HIV or other things to bind and deleted it from new babies. So the answer to your question is no. So we're nowhere near.
Darn it.
Yeah, exactly. We're nowhere near. It actually brings up a good point. Why sickle cell disease? Why have we focused on sickle cell disease, right? And we can talk about that because I have views on that and why we're doing that. But when we think about diseases, we think about them as being monogenic, caused by one gene or one protein, or polygenic, which is a host of factors. A good example of this is blood pressure control, right? People who have high blood pressure, it's not just one particular bad actor in our DNA that makes us do this. It's a bunch of different things, right? Sickle cell disease, we benefit from having, 60 years of basic science research on understanding hemoglobin, how it's made, the genetic problems between normal hemoglobin and sickled hemoglobin. And it's relatively easy to understand what's going on. Whereas in complex diseases, we know some of the proteins that are involved, but we don't know all of them. Mm-hmm. We're also not very good at targeting every single cell in our body, right? One of the unique features of targeting diseases that come from our bone marrow, right? So sickle cell, there's certain cells that our bone marrow makes. Bone marrow makes red blood cells. Our bone marrow makes platelets. These are the things that stop bleeding, scabs, clots, and then makes our immune cells. And so this is a particularly easy tissue to get for physicians, right? We can either just go in the bone marrow and get it, or we can actually just sort of trick your bone marrow to leave its home in your bone marrow and get it in your blood. So this is something that we've been able to do easily. It's very difficult to get the cells that are responsible for making a liver, for making, ears, for making hair, for making eyes. We're not quite there yet.
So the uniqueness of thinking about CRISPR and sickle disease is you've got an actual one defect, essentially. It's not like you have 700 defects that you need to target all, right? You have like one defect in sickle cell disease, and if you're able to target that, you are going to potentially change the course of the disease.
Yeah, exactly. And to make it a little bit more complicated, there's actually one. I talked to you about those amino acids, or those nucleotides, those building blocks of DNA. There are four of them: T, C, G, and A. That's what we call them.
Mm-hmm.
There's an exchange in one of the genes that encodes hemoglobin, and there's just one base, we call it a base, one nucleotide that is mutated in sickle cell disease. Just one. Not a length of DNA. It's just one piece, one nucleotide. One of those, and in fact, an A is changed to a T. That's the
so
that's
literally,
the
if you can fix that, you fix the disease.
You fix everything. Now, that has been proven to be very difficult to do. And the gene therapies, for sort of biologic reasons, the gene therapies that are in existence today for sickle cell disease actually don't change that one mutation. They actually change a protein. The CRISPR-Cas9 changes a protein that is responsible for that hemoglobin switch that we talked about when you're born, right? So interestingly, when patients with sickle cell disease, when they're little, up to about 6 months of age, they very rarely have any problems associated with sickle cell disease. And the reason for that is so they're making that switch from fetal hemoglobin that does not sickle and is not mutated to that adult form of hemoglobin that we have for the rest of our lives. Research knows the exact molecular, the exact proteins that are responsible for that switch, that we call it a hemoglobin switch. And actually, the gene target that most gene therapies against sickle cell disease being studied right now in the CRISPR-Cas9 system targets a protein. It's a master regulator of that switch, and it's called BCL11A. And by silencing that protein, you stop the switch from fetal to adult, and you can bring back that fetal hemoglobin, which works perfectly. Binds oxygen, does not sickle. And actually, we also benefit in sickle cell disease. There's something called hereditary persistence of fetal hemoglobin. So these are patients with sickle cell disease that for some reason, their fetal hemoglobin doesn't turn off all the way, and they make it throughout their life. And what's interesting is those patients, even though they have sickled hemoglobin, they have normal life expectancies. Mm. They don't have organ damage. They don't have strokes. They don't have anything. So we benefit in sickle cell disease by knowing that what nature has provided us to say, gosh, if we could just bring back that fetal hemoglobin, patients will do fine. And that's exactly what the goal of the CRISPR strategy is for patients now.
That's really perfect explanation. So CRISPR, you mentioned like 11, 12 years ago when it was started to, the technology became a little bit more available.
Mm-hmm.
When did you guys start seriously thinking of using CRISPR to cure or control, although I'm going to argue it's probably a cure, sickle cell disease? Like, this just started recently? Has it started 11 years ago? Like, how did this all start?
Yeah. So my involvement in this, so this was a study, one that was recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine at the end of last year. This was a study that was run by multiple companies, but led by a company called Novartis. And I was one of a few other investigators that were brought in to say, gosh, how do we tackle this problem? Where do we start? And so it really was a group effort between pharma, between the folks who could build the targeting, CRISPR targeting system, and how you got these into patients with sickle cell disease in the hospital, in the real world. And we started that process, we started that process a number of years before COVID. At conferences, we would get together and say, how do we tackle this? What do we do? How many cells do we need? What should we target? How are we going to get these into patients? And the it took a number of years to work that out. It also took a number of years to provide the evidence that was going to work. We thought it was going to work. And much of that was done through pharma collaboration, which we would not have been able to do something on this scale without without them.
It's another example that, I mean, in order for us to help patients, everybody has to row in the same direction, right? I mean, and everybody would benefit. Hopefully, the ultimate beneficiary is the patient. What can you share with us about the study? This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in late 2023, and obviously was covered extensively by many outlets and many big circulations from Wall Street Journal to other things. But what can you tell us, tell listeners?
So this was super exciting for the field, I think. It was the first example of using CRISPR-Cas9 gene therapy for this disease. So, and what was done is it was a report of the first three patients. Two of those patients had their bone marrow transplanted, which I'll get into in a moment, for a year, and the third patient was only 6 months out from their transplantation. And the idea was that we would collect stem cells from patients with sickle cell disease in the hospital. So they would be admitted to the hospital here or elsewhere. We would take their stem cells. We would actually freeze their stem cells on site here. And that's actually a very important part of this study. And the whole hope behind that was, gosh, if most patients with sickle cell disease are in places with transportation issues or with an inability to coordinate manufacturing, could they just freeze the cells on site and then batch them and then send them for manufacturing? That was the whole premise of the study. So we actually took the cells, kept them here, sent them to a manufacturing facility through Novartis, where they did the genetic editing. And how they did the genetic editing, they used CRISPR. And the nice thing about CRISPR, unlike sometimes we talk, people are very familiar with gene therapy. We're not adding a gene here. There's nothing that we're adding, in this case, right? We're not using a virus, let's say, a modified virus to bring a completely foreign protein into the cells, right? This is gene editing, rather than perhaps gene therapy, right? So there's nothing inside the cell when it's given back to the patient except that edited protein. So we targeted where that BCL11A, that protein, we targeted that. The patients were then brought back to the hospital. They were admitted to the hospital and got high doses of chemotherapy to wipe out all of their sickled stem cells, the stem cells that their normal stem cells that had the sickled hemoglobin gene. And we did a bone marrow transplant. And the bone marrow transplant is we took those cells, you hang them on a bag next to the patient, and you infuse them into their bloodstream. And stem cells know exactly where to go. Bone marrow stem cells, although they travel through your bloodstream, they know exactly where to go and start setting up shop and making babies, and that's the bone marrow. So, and it takes about a month. So patients were admitted to the hospital for about a month until we saw evidence that their bone marrow had, regrown this new bone marrow. And we followed them. And what was amazing to see is these patients, prior to this therapy, had been admitted to the hospital many times a year for, bad pain crises, lost time at work and school, weren't able to have functional jobs or difficulty even having peer relationships because they were always in the hospital. They had terrible lung problems. And what happened was these patients left the hospital, and sure enough, we saw evidence that their fetal hemoglobin started to increase over time. And while this fetal hemoglobin increased, their pain crises went away. They were not hospitalized for anything. They didn't lose any time away from work or school and were able to have functional lives. And it was really remarkable. These patients were still following long term. It has changed their lives.
So, but there is no way to do this without giving these high doses of chemotherapy, is there?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Because
So
that is always the, you know.
it's a it that's the terrible exchange for this sort of therapy at this point. I think the only way we have now at our disposal to the only way we know how to do this safely is to use high dose chemotherapy to kill all the old bones. Now, what is for those of your listeners who may know someone who had got who's gotten chemotherapy, you know, chemotherapy affects rapidly dividing cells. Your hair falls out. You can have some toxicity from it, and most importantly, it can affect your fertilization, right? Your ability for sperm and eggs to work normally, and so that is an exchange that we talk, you know, a lot about with patients. And it's something that the field is desperately trying to work toward in providing a way to get rid of those old stem cells and replacing them with new stem cells without the chemotherapy, but we're not there yet.
I mean, it is still a huge upgrade from the regular allogeneic stem cell transplantation because, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, you don't have to deal with GVHD or graft versus host disease here, right? I mean, you're really just giving the same cells, just modified.
That's a perfect point. So the other problem with the curative therapies for the previous curative therapies for bone marrow transplant is, or for sickle cell disease, as I told you, was a normal bone marrow transplant and receiving stem cells from somebody who doesn't have sickle cell disease. The problem with that is that comes with their own immune system. And when you get somebody else's immune system inside you and it's growing inside of you, it can react to you and see you as foreign. And that's called graft, which is the bone marrow, versus host, which is the new person, disease. So graft versus host disease. And that can be a debilitating chronic illness. So you never want to, you know, as a physician, you never want to exchange one debilitating illness for another debilitating illness. That's just terrible. And that's where we were sometimes.
For sure. And the other thing is probably difficult to find a match for African American populations.
It's very hard. So when we do bone marrow transplants for all sorts of diseases, some like sickle cell disease and hemophilia, but some cancers like leukemias and metabolic diseases and bubble boy sort of syndromes where you don't have a working immune system. And you have to find a perfect match. We match some proteins that, and that's what we call a match. And patients with sickle cell disease, unfortunately, on average, only 17% of the time can we find a matched related donor that is a perfect match, right? And that leaves most patients with sickle cell disease unable to find a perfect match, a related match. This foregoes that. You are your own donor. So theoretically, every single person with sickle cell disease could qualify for this.
And James, we a couple of things, and then I want to just I hopefully I won't run out of time. I want to talk about like future directions and other diseases, it looks like there were, I mean, are there different, you mentioned that you worked with Novartis on this. Are there other companies, like what do other companies do that are going to this space? Like if, like I'm trying to understand where the competition is, because this is really getting a gene and you're basically replacing it with the, it's not like a new drug. You're gonna do another drug. So is the competition on the rapidity of things, how fast you can get things done? Is it on the cost? Is it on the logistics? What are we competing? How what do they compete against each other for?
That's a great question. We could spend probably a whole day talking about this. Let's start with targets, right? So I told you that the CRISPR-Cas9 system uses nucleotides, those base pairs, those building blocks, to target certain portions of a gene. It turns out that there's all sorts of spaces overlapping genes or overlapping code that you could target. And right now, nobody knows what's the best. Okay. So, you know, these therapies are very new. Patients who have had these therapies are only 2, 3 years out from getting them. We don't know what will happen 40 years from now to those stem cells. And so People are still looking for the best target. Now, we have very good targets right now. It changes people's lives, and that's why the FDA continues to move forward. So you can edit that BCL11A, knock it out, doesn't work. You can degrade it, so allow BCL11A to be made, and then use some other molecular machinery to just get rid of it. It's called shRNA. That's another way that people are doing this. There are two FDA-approved products. One is from Vertex, that's the CRISPR-Cas9. The other one is from bluebird bio, and that actually is gene therapy, so that's a little different than CRISPR in that they're actually inserting a non-sickling hemoglobin. It's not quite adult hemoglobin, but it's very similar to adult hemoglobin, and it turns out it doesn't sickle. And so those are the two FDA-approved therapies. The symptom control after getting these therapies is remarkable in both cases, but we don't yet know which is the best. And
But
you brought
you're
up.
not curing the disease, right? I mean, you're really the CRISPR, you're obviously giving the high-dose chemotherapy, you're inserting cells that are different, you're kind of curing the disease, dare I say, the other one, you're not, no?
Well, I would argue that you're not curing the disease in either case. What you're doing is you're providing a lifelong treatment for the disease where someone doesn't need to take any medication every day, like
Right.
hydroxyurea. Because while you still make, we do a very good job of editing stem cells, but some stem cells just aren't edited. It's not 100%. And so there are some cells that still make the sickled hemoglobin. And you make a combination of sickled hemoglobin and this fetal hemoglobin in the CRISPR-Cas9s. And it wipes away any of the problems with sickled hemoglobin, but you still make sickled hemoglobin. Whereas if I gave you or I a bone marrow transplant from and I had sickle cell disease and I got bone marrow from someone who just didn't have sickle cell disease, I would not make sickled hemoglobin at all. That's a cure. In the gene therapy, the bluebird product, they still make sickled hemoglobin, but they make this other new non-sickling hemoglobin. And the combination of those two things allows them not to sickle,
It's almost
right?
like the
Yeah.
percentage. Yeah.
So while it's a symptomatic cure,
Right.
it's not really a cure of the disease.
Yeah. Very interesting. My last couple of questions to you, James. I want to be very sensitive to your time. What other diseases out there? I know you're a pediatric hematologist oncologist, so I won't ask you to comment on adults. Can you think about other diseases where that technology could be applicable, whether it is gene editing, whatever? Like this to me, honestly, like if when I was in residency, if you tell me about this stuff you're talking about, I would think you're like, come on, this is like science fiction. But here we are. This is amazing. Can we think about other diseases where you, your group, your collaborators are thinking about taking this and taking to other diseases that you might help patients?
That's the coolest part, right? In 10 years from now, there'll be lots of diseases that we treat with gene therapy or CRISPR therapy,
Right.
right? The other disease that we treat using these exact same products is a disease called beta thalassemia, which is also ravages a huge proportion of people in the world. And this is when you don't make a sickled hemoglobin, you actually make a totally non-functional hemoglobin. It doesn't work at all. And so these patients from birth, as they switch to that adult hemoglobin, need monthly transfusions forever. And that brings lots of other problems, like iron overload and organ problems. And this same technology is actually can be used, the same idea and the same products, almost very similar products, can be used to treat patients with beta thalassemia, which is exciting. So that's a whole nother population of people in the world, huge population of people that can be treated with this. You may have heard over the last few weeks there was an article about some children in at the University of Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that were treated for neonatal loss of hearing. So they had a disease in a protein in their inner ears that didn't allow them to hear. They injected gene-edited cells into those into or gene editing material into their inner ear, and I think 7 of 8 of those children began to hear, and they had never heard before. They were deaf.
That's amazing. I mean,
That it's
really,
amazing,
really, it's
truly
amazing.
amazing. There are forms of colorblindness that people are looking into, retinal problems that they can go in and take care of the gene that's the problem. So again, there are lots of monogenic, one gene
Right.
related diseases that it's going to change the world, I
I mean,
think.
you do. I mean, and potentially, I mean, who the heck knows? It could start applying to polygenic diseases, no?
Oh, I hope so.
In the
Yeah,
future.
I don't see why not, right?
Yeah.
I think as we learn how to do this faster, cheaper, more cost effectively, more durably, I think more and more diseases
Yeah.
that we talk, we know a lot about the biologic mechanisms of diseases. We've been studying this for 60 years, and I would argue it's weak. The cure for some of these diseases isn't because we don't know the mechanisms, it's because we can't drug them. So with normal drugs that you and I take in pill form, this offers hope for those proteins that we can't drug.
It's the tip of the iceberg. Are there any things I should have asked you as we finish this episode I completely forgot, or anything you want to leave our listeners with?
No, I think it's an exciting time. I think this will give hope to lots of people who can be treated early before the disease ravages parts of their body. I think one of the biggest sticking points right now is the price tag. I don't know if
Yeah.
you bought the price tag of some of these therapies.
I heard.
One of the FDA approved therapies is $3.1 million, and the other is $2.2 million. They're fantastically expensive. No one can afford these therapies. And so the big challenge now is how do we make them cheaper and how do we pay for them,
I
right?
guess what I don't understand, what I couldn't understand, and that's obviously not something we can address today, is I don't understand where these numbers come from. I'm trying to get. It's one thing to try to justify $100,000 cancer treatment, and another thing is 3 million. I mean, I don't understand where the numbers came from, but we need like a policy person to answer that question, not you or
Yeah,
I guess.
people are looking at that actually at the federal level.
Yeah.
What's the return on this investment?
Yeah.
I think the return on this investment from a person standpoint, from a personal standpoint, is incalculable, right? You've changed someone's life. Just like sequencing the human genome took $1 billion and months, and now you can do it for $1,000 over 2 days.
Right.
The hope is that this therapy will come down too. I mean, there's been an enormous amount of research and development devoted to these therapies. They're still quite complicated. And the other reason why these are so expensive is it involves bone marrow transplantation, right? Which is inherently an expensive
Sure,
process.
of course. Well, Dr. James LaBelle, I couldn't be more thankful for your time coming on Healthcare Unfiltered. I would love to have you in the future again, talk a little bit more about these new things. Congratulations on all of the work you're doing and your collaborators and everyone involved. Patients stand to benefit from your expertise and your work.
Oh, thanks, Chadi. It's been a sincere pleasure. Thank you.
Folks, thank you so much for listening, and thank you for being on Healthcare Unfiltered. Thank you for supporting this podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to it, rate it, and write a brief review. You can watch all of these podcast episodes on my YouTube channel, Chadi Nabhan and Healthcare Unfiltered. And you can follow me on Twitter at Chadi Nabhan or on Instagram, Chadi underscore healthcare unfiltered. You can always share what your opinion is. And if you are a loyal listener, just ask for the Healthcare Unfiltered podcast t-shirt, which I will mail to you as long as you are willing to post it on social media and you are listening to this podcast. Well, before I let you go, I'm going to leave you with a saying by Winston Churchill. Attitude is a little thing that makes a big difference. Until next time, take care.